This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. The science consensus is that birds are really just flying dinosaurs. Look at their scaly legs, just like a mini raptor, right? And we have plenty of dino fossils, some of which have beautiful arrays of feathers on them. But this week, scientists announced a new find, a 130-million-year-old fossil that might be the first true modern bird. Here to tell us about it and other selected short subjects in science, Rachel Feltman. She runs the Speaking of Science blog at the Washington Post. She's here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me again, Ira.
The oldest modern bird of the mollusks?
Well, so what it is it's the oldest relative of living birds, because obviously we know that birds are just dinosaurs, but not all avian dinosaurs lived to have modern bird descendants. There's this entire group of avian dinosaurs that just completely died off. They had teeth, they had clawed wings, and modern birds come from a different group. And this is the oldest ever example of a member of that group that was able to make it. So scientists are very interested in how this group was different and at what point they started to show up, what point they started to dominate the scene. So this bird is almost 131 million years old. It was alive during the early Cretaceous in China. And until now, the oldest example of this group was 125 million years old. And what's cool about this bird is that it's more bird-like in the modern sense than even later specimens that have been found. So that probably means that the oldest member of this group actually came out a lot earlier, so that multiple lineages were able to emerge, some of them becoming more bird-like more quickly.
And it looks like a bird?
Well, you know, a lot of it is based on imagination, but there was a lot of plumage, so they think that it did have the power to fly. And based on its legs, they think it was like some kind of shorebird. So it might not have looked that different from a gull of some kind.
Wow, that's quite interesting. And we don't have it in a museum anywhere to take a look at.
No, not yet.
Not yet. Second story, the most distant galaxies on your list.
Yes. So basically, scientists have confirmed the most distant galaxy ever measured. So this is one that was spotted by the Hubble, but now they've used something called the MOSFIRE instrument on the Keck Observatory, and they've confirmed that it's so distant that we're seeing it as it was 13 billion years ago, when the universe was 5% of the age it is now. The galaxy was already 15% of the mass of the Milky Way after just 670 million years since the dawn of the universe, and it was making stars at a rate 80 times faster than the Milky Way does. So basically, we're seeing this great example of some of the earliest galaxy we've ever been able to observe, and they behaved very differently then. And once the James Webb telescope is launched in 2018, we'll be able to push the limits of that distance even more.
You know, what's interesting about all of this is the further away you look, you're actually looking back in history.
Right, right. And that actually is a nice segue to my next space story, because astronomers spotted what they're calling a dinosaur egg about to hatch in space. It's a what they think is the precursor of something called a globular cluster, which is when this high density of stars forms a sphere, and it's tons of star formation. It's super bright, and most of them are really old. They formed a long time ago. But they were able to spot this one that seems to be about to form. It's this incredibly dense cloud of gas. It has 50 million times the mass of our sun. And if they're right, they could be looking at what's about to hatch into a globular cluster, which is something that we thought happened much too long ago for us to see.
Can we watch it hatch?
That's probably going to take about a million years.
Oh, well, hey, I got time.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, a million years. There's a big question in biology, right? That from how we went from the simple cells?
Yes. So biologists say they found a missing link between simple-celled organisms and the complex cells, the eukaryotes that have organelles and host mitochondria, everything you need to form what we consider complex life, plants, fungi, animals. So the idea is that eukaryotes actually all came from a branch of archaea, which are simple-celled. They're prokaryotes. And researchers found this organism down at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean called Loki. And it's simple. It's prokaryotic. It's an archaea. But they think it has the toolkit necessary for complex life. It has genes that eukaryotes use to have all of the organelles and do all of the functions that make complex life. Mm-hmm. So the idea is that we must have shared a common ancestor with this simple organism, and that common ancestor could be where eukaryotes came from.
Hmm. And finally, the microbiome. We know we love the microbiome.
Yes, and I love the microbiome.
Good. We're on the same page on this. Give us a good story about a microbiome.
Right. So last week, a lot of places were reporting that beards are covered in poop. They're dirtier than toilets.
Drive home safely, everybody. Beards covered in, yes.
Right. Yeah. But it turns out that what was being reported was not a real study. It was a media outlet that had done some random street swabs of beards and had one microbiologist look at them. And he basically said, well, these have gut bacteria in them. And you know what else has gut bacteria in it? Poop. Ergo, beards full of poop.
That's a leap of faith.
It's a pretty big leap. So I wrote a post on my blog because I am always defending the microbes.
Good for you.
There's bacteria everywhere, including bacteria that's in poop. And unless you've been putting your beard somewhere funny, you probably don't have anything that you need to worry about. Yeah. And frankly, we're all covered in poop bacteria, and it's all okay.
And we all share it.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is well-known
stuff. It's part of us.
It's there. Yeah, and we leave it behind and take everybody else's. That's a good way to end, Rachel.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend.
You too.
Rachel Feldman, she runs the Speaking of Science blog at The Washington Post. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. If you're on Facebook, you might have noticed that you don't actually see everything your friends post. You know how that works? It's probably a good thing because who needs to see 20 pictures of your second cousin's pet parakeet, right? Well, Facebook uses algorithms to figure out what users want to see and to give it to them. But what if those same algorithms keep us from seeing new stories that challenge our political beliefs? Are our news feeds prone to the so-called filter effect? That's the subject of a new study out yesterday from the researchers at Facebook. It's in the journal Science. And here to share the good and bad is Mashable.com science editor Andrew Friedman. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So what's the good thing about this?
So the good thing really is that the Facebook algorithm, which I think so many people, including myself, are often suspicious about, because it's so opaque and we don't really know what's controlling our newsfeed. The Facebook algorithm is not, at least by itself, walling us off from content that might challenge our political beliefs. In other words, the dreaded filter effect or echo chamber hypothesis of social media isn't quite taking place, at least not to the dreaded levels that people think.
Ah, and the bad news.
The bad news is that we ourselves may actually be having a bigger influence on what comes across Facebook's newsfeed and what types of ideological content we come into contact with than the actual algorithm. It means that if we keep clicking on links only offered up by our liberal friends but not from our conservative uncle, we'll see an increase in the amount of info from our liberal friends in Facebook, because Facebook wants to offer you content that you are going to like and that you are going to click on. But even then, they still saw that people saw about 25% of cross-cutting content. But the study indicates, so the bad thing, you know, there still is that the study indicates that the combined influence, if you take the newsfeed effect and our click-through effects, it does, in the end, make us a little bit more isolated ideologically.
Hey, isn't what, some of the good news about this, I would think, is that also Facebook is publishing in Science, the journal Science. Wow, their research.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating, and it's fascinating that, you know, the research was done on 10.1 million Facebook users who self-identify their political affiliation. Facebook has 1.4 billion users. They still got a pretty big data set, and they offered up, you know, the research, and they want to collaborate with other researchers in the future.
Can we expect more of these kinds of studies coming out?
I think so. I think it's important to do so. You know, one of the things is Facebook, your Facebook friends come from shared experiences and shared phases in your life. So school, camp, some class you may have taken once, coworkers. Other social networks like Twitter especially are based on shared interests. So they might have even more of a filter effect or echo chamber effect. And researching, you know, the types of effects of those social networks is probably the next step that I'd really like to see in addition to Facebook.
Yeah, and the fact that they're taking the being able to use these giant pieces of data, right, with all these millions of people, billions could be in Facebook's case.
Yes, yes.
And make some meaningful results out of it.
Yeah, statistically, it adds up. I mean, this is still only 9% of Facebook users that they looked at, so some critics are pointing to that and saying, well, you can't quite generalize down to the individual level or to the average Facebook user.
Yeah.
But still, it gives us a good general idea of whether this dreaded filter effect is really a big influence or just sort of a relatively, you know, still sizable but not nightmarish influence. And it seems to be, at least according to this one study, it seems to be the latter.
All right. We're going to see if Twitter strikes back with something in nature one of these days.
Exactly.
Thank you. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us, Andrew. Andrew Friedman, science editor at Mashable.com. We're going to take a break. And when we come back, Barry Esterbrook is here talking about big pork, the pork industry. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I want you to picture a big farm. Yeah, you got it in your mind. What do you see? Hogs lazing in the mud, piglets squealing as they run round to mom, right? Well, that may be the Hollywood version, circa 1938. But in reality, some 97% of pigs are raised in mega farms, the pork industry, or as my next guest calls it, big pig. Living conditions are pretty far from the sloppy, muddy farmhouse version. Some of these pork factories are so germ-phobic, the requirements to get in are more strict than a NASA clean room. You have to strip naked, shower, put on a whole new outfit, new shoes, just to step inside. Well, you'll see rows and rows and rows as far as the eye can see of pigs wedged into containers. Barry Esterbrook knows a thing or two about that. He saw it himself at Elite Pork in Western Iowa. He's the author of Pigtails, an omnivore's quest for sustainable meat. We have an excerpt at sciencefriday.com/pork. He also wrote Tomatoland, another sci-fi favorite, and he joins us here in our New York studios. Welcome back, Barry.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just do some unfinished business from Tomatoland. Because you've written about undocumented immigrants in Florida trapped into virtual slavery by the tomato growers. Has that improved at all since you wrote that?
You know, I'm really glad to say that Tomatoland is completely dated in the best of possible ways. I mean, it's been a sea change. It's like, you know, leaving a Dickensian workhouse and going into a modern, enlightened Silicon Valley company. They have, you know, they're making 50% more money. There have been no reports of slavery. There's a third-party auditing organization that's keeping track of how things are going in the field. So it's been a dramatic change.
Do you think you can do that for the meatpacking industry?
Boy, it would be exciting, wouldn't it?
Well, tell us the difference between the workers there and the workers. Were they like the workers in the tomato fields or the meatpacking industry?
Well, no. The tomato industry was starting from a very low level. When you've got slavery being a kind of frequent aspect of your workforce. But what's happening in the meatpacking industry is, while the tomato industry is getting better steadily, meatpacking is basically in a free fall. You know, in the mid-80s, working in a slaughterhouse, a meat plant, was a really good, solid, middle-class career. You'd be making considerably more than the average manufacturing employee, and your job would be just as safe as working in any factory. Today, they're making 25-30% less than the average manufacturing employee, and working in slaughterhouses is the most dangerous manufacturing job.
How are they able to get away with this kind of these conditions?
Well, they tore a page from the fast food industry in that they broke the process of disassembling a carcass down into very simple steps that anyone can do without training. You know, you may just make the same cut with a knife all day long, repetitively. And the second thing they did, they moved the slaughterhouses from, they used to be on the edge of large cities like Chicago and highly unionized. Well, they moved the slaughterhouses out into the country, closer to the pigs, but and further away from organized labor.
You write about two very different types of factories in the book. One required a shower, like I mentioned in the introduction, just to get inside, and the other had dead animals rotting in the aisles. Why such a difference?
Well, the fellow who ran the pig farm that where they call it showering in and showering out, because you shower both ways, he's regarded as one of the finest pork producers in the country, albeit very industrial scale, and he's a former veterinarian. Mm-hmm. So he's very cautious about things like that, and he's very conscientious. The other barn was owned by a large corporation, and the people working in that barn, you know, the head office was thousands of miles away, so they weren't really supervised in the same way that the guys at Elite Pork were, and you know, they took shortcuts whenever they could, and often that meant things like not tending to sick pigs, allowing dead pigs just to remain in the barns instead of being taken off to the rendering facilities, allowing pigs to become sick and not treating them because they were employees and they had to work fast and they had to produce a lot. And so shortcuts were the inevitable result.
So how would you describe the working conditions in there?
Working conditions are horrific. Mainly because, you know, these giant pig barns, the pigs are on hard slatted floors. And all of their feces and urine either falls through those slats or squishes through most times and builds up underneath in a giant pit. So it would really be the equivalent to just allowing your own waste to accumulate in your basement. And it sits there for a year. And it's giving off horrific gases. It's not just a bad smell. It's ammonia. It's hydrogen sulfide, which are poisonous. Mm-hmm. You know, they wreck your respiratory system. They can wreck your nervous system. And the people who work in these barns, you know, they've been studied. They have, you know, a lot more respiratory problems than the average person, and they have a decreased lung capacity, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you write about lawsuits brought by the neighbors who live by the farms who just can't stand the smell and the condition.
Yeah, these huge pig farms move in, and they don't have to treat their waste. There can be 50 or 60,000 pigs or more on a farm. Well, they excrete way more than 50 or 60,000 human beings. But a city of 50 or 60,000 human beings has to have a very elaborate sewage processing plant. A pig farm, it can just spread its waste on the land, let it build up in giant pools, and then spray it over the land. And as it sprays over the land, it vaporizes some of it and drifts over to neighbors. And again, it's not just an unpleasant aroma. It drives up their blood pressure, for instance.
Let's go to the phones, 844-724-8255. Bob in Washington, Iowa. Hi, Bob.
Hey, how are you?
Hey there.
I've enjoyed your program for years, and first I want to say I haven't read Barry's book. I'm a hog farmer. Just the comments that Barry went through, I find it outrageous, first, that he's on a science program giving you this kind of information without really having any representation from the industry. And again, I liked a lot of the stuff in Tomato Land. I think that's valuable work, and there are certainly things to criticize in the pork industry, some of which Barry mentioned just there. But let's just take one comment he just made, where he talked about we don't have to treat the waste. And he talked about the pools of manure under the building. You know, the average person, when I tell neighbors, I actually live in the city and I split time at my farm, and when I explain how this works to them, you know, it's appalling at face value to think of these animals are kept above a giant pool of waste. But in reality, there are pit fans that are diluting that gas that comes off of those pits. It goes out of the buildings. You get fresh air. Barry's correct. There are studies that show some damages. But there are also places that are doing it like he talked about earlier. There are farms that have the resources. They do things properly and by the book, and there are always people that don't do it by the book. But in my buildings, I've got what he would call an industrial-style building, even though I'm an independent producer and I belong to a co-op. I can go into that building. I don't want to spend 24 hours a day there, that's true, but the hog is only going to live in that building for 3 or 4 months. Fresh air is coming down out of ceiling inlets. The air gas is being expelled all the time. Even your lead-in to this article, it's no wonder, see, farmers out here, in case you aren't aware of it, they feel like there's a war against agriculture out here. The attacks on GMOs with no, you know, basis in science for them.
Okay, Bob, let me get a reaction.
Okay, sorry to run on.
No, it's you're very passionate. I want to find what Barry has to say, because Barry, there's a lot of research, a lot of good research. I wanted to know why you have such different perspective on this.
Well, first of all, I agree that there are very, you know, as I said, they're very conscientious large-scale hog farmers. But I do think there are problems and they need to be addressed, and one of them is the way that waste is handled. I mean, the city of Des Moines, Iowa, has to spend millions of dollars every year to remove agricultural waste from the drinking water supply. There's something wrong that a farmer upstream or farmers can continue to do that sort of pollution. And I also think there's something wrong if you're farming in such a way that your neighbors really can't enjoy their own quality of life.
Mm-hmm. How did you get access to these farms?
I spoke with the owner, and I simply told him that I would report accurately what I saw. Nothing mm-hmm. more, nothing less. Mm-hmm. And I didn't see anything appalling. I didn't see any of the PETA, you know, those images. I didn't see anything that would cause me to think that there was anything like that going on. Mm-hmm. But it's not to say it doesn't go on.
Mm-hmm. Does it go on in the majority of pig farms, or?
I asked the guy who reported those conditions, the horrific conditions yeah. on the giant farm owned by a pork conglomerate. And he said it was fairly common in all of that company's buildings.
Mm-hmm. Is there a place where, you know, you would hold up as a model for how pigs could be raised? Because part of the book you talk about searching for sustainability in this industry.
Well, there are certainly new models being explored. I think the example of what the farmers who belong to the Nyman Ranch, which is a marketing umbrella organization, the independent farmers, some of them raise large numbers of pigs and they don't raise them in confinement buildings. Even small improvements. I went to Denmark, where their pig barns are every bit as big and crammed and industrial and sophisticated as any you'll see in Iowa. And they can produce pork, for instance, without feeding the animals low doses of antibiotics, which our farmers tend to do here. Their pigs have, their female pigs are not kept crated during their pregnancies. Mm-hmm. They're allowed to roam around free. So there could be small improvements mm-hmm. even within the industrial model.
Let's go to the phones to Aaron in Central Hampshire. Is that Central New Hampshire, Aaron?
Yes, that's Central New Hampshire. Thank you very much for taking my call. I appreciate it. I just wanted to offer just another farmer's perspective. I'm actually a small-scale, mostly vegetable farmer, and I do have some laying hens as well. Thought about getting into pork, and we have a really great agricultural support here in New England in general. And the last caller that made a comment about Gary's book, which I actually look forward to reading very much, so one comment he made was this perceived war on agriculture. And I think there is a war on agriculture. However, I think it's maybe a war on a specific kind of agriculture. And I think that's where a lot of the pushback, I think, from the public is coming from. And not just in the public, I'm including myself in that because I am a part of the public too. And I think if we were to focus more on small-scale agriculture, there'd be a rippling effect throughout the economy, not to mention, I think, going against a lot of these mega operations, regardless of how sanitary they are. It's just not how you're supposed to raise animals. And the more that you get into local small-scale agriculture, I think you really realize the benefits, not just from animal well-being and welfare, but the health aspects for us as the end consumer as well. Mm-hmm. So thank you very much. I just wanted to offer that alternative opinion.
Thank you, Aaron. I'm talking with Barry Esterbrook, author of Pigtails, an omnivore's quest for sustainable meat, on Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. So the feelings is big farm versus small farmer seems to be the pushback.
Well, I think so. I think pork can be raised commercially and profitably on a smaller scale. And you end up with the best of all worlds. You end up with really good tasting meat for the consumer. The land, the environment doesn't get harmed, and the animals are raised in a non-abusive way. They're able to exert their their essential pigginess.
Mm-hmm. I think ironically, the factory farm where you had to get all washed and suited up, I talked about that, had a huge disease outbreak shortly after you visited, didn't it?
Well, sadly, these epidemics seem to sweep through every dozen years or so. They come out of nowhere and they sweep through the industry. And the latest one is a diarrhea epidemic. And essentially, every pig in the barn that gets infected, every piglet will die. And it's killed over 8 million pigs inside of a year and a half in this country.
Did you get any? Have you ever been struck by any of the diseases as you walk through the pig barn?
No, humans can't get this diarrhea. But I was in the barn when he didn't know it at the time, but he had it, and a few days later it went rampant. He lost every piglet born in his facility, 15,000 piglets, over the next couple of months.
Wow. So where do you think the low-hanging fruit to improving those conditions in the bad spots are?
Well, we're getting some low-hanging fruit that's being picked thanks to consumer resistance. One of them is these horrible gestation crates that sows are kept in. These big sows, when they're pregnant, are kept in cages that are too small for them to turn around. In fact, if you look at them, the sow's shoulders and hams are bulging through the metal bars on the cages. And that's the way they live their whole life, except when they move into a farrowing crate, which really doesn't give the sow much more room. That's going. That's going by the wayside because of consumer pressure. I really think we need to deal with the use of subtherapeutic antibiotics on the farm. There's no place for them in agriculture because they're for humans.
Mm-hmm.
That's low-hanging fruit.
And what about the big waste pits? Is that already being taken care of, you think?
Well, I think the farmers are going to have to face it, not because of government action, but because of lawsuits. We're talking about Des Moines. Well, Des Moines is now suing three counties upstream.
The
city water department is saying, clean up the mess. I mean, why should Des Moines pay over $1 million a year to clean agricultural waste out of its drinking water?
Mm-hmm.
And there are other citizen lawsuits working their way through the courts. So that may be a solution to some of the pollution problems.
Well, Barry, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
A very interesting read. Barry Esterbrook, author of Pigtails, An Omnivore's Quest for Sustainable Meat. And we have an excerpt of the book if you want to read it. Quite interesting. ScienceFriday.com/pork. We're going to take a break. And after the break, the Sci-Fry Science Club is back with a new assignment for you to go outside and take a look. Well, I'll tell you what you should be taking a look at when we come back. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Yes. That means the Science Friday Science Club is now in session. The Science Club wants you to go out, try their new project, and share it with everybody. Here to explain this season's project are two of the founding members of the Science Club, our education manager, Ariel Zitch.
Hello.
Hey there. Our director, Charles Berquist.
Hi, Ira.
Good to see you again. Ariel, what's the project this time?
Well, in the past, we've asked you guys to make things. We asked you to make an art machine, and most recently, we asked you to go out and observe something. This time, we want you to explain something.
Explain? I'm glad you're not asking me to explain something.
Something really, really big. We want you to explain to us what the sun does.
What the sun does.
Right. So we kind of take the sun for granted. Right? We look at it, it's beautiful, it's warming, it's bright, but we don't really think about what it does. It's this giant part of our lives, and it's part of our planet, it's part of our ecosystems. What is it doing up there? What is it doing to our skin? What is it doing to everything? We want you to explain that to us.
And Charles, how do we want you to explain it? We want you to take a picture of you eating an ice cream cone at the beach?
Or... Well, I'd like you to give a bit more thought than, you know, a picture of you on the beach with a daiquiri or something. use a bit of thought. Think about what the sun is to you, how it interacts with your life. We've been asking a lot of different people this question, and It really has been interesting. The reactions that we get really tell you something a little bit about the person who gave the response and what they do in their everyday life. So first, for example, we asked the Energy Secretary, Ernest Moniz, what the sun meant to him, and here's what he said.
What does the sun do? Let's talk sun and energy. First, the sun's surface temperature, you know, is about 10,000 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's a big energy source driven by fusing together hydrogen. We're trying to harness that fusion process on Earth, but it's very hard and expensive. In the meantime, we use the light from the sun here on Earth to make energy directly. In 1 hour, the solar energy hitting Earth is enough to meet the world's energy needs for about a year. Solar energy technology is making great strides, and we think it will be a major source of carbon-free electricity in the years ahead as the costs keep falling and energy storage allows us to use the electricity even when the sun is not shining.
So that's interesting because, you know, when we say to the Energy Secretary, what does the sun mean to you? You get an energy response,
get
right?
A physics lesson, right?
Right, exactly. But we wanted to ask some other folks that same question. In particular, you know, what does a botanist think the sun does?
The sun provides energy. Plants transform the sun's energy into stored chemical energy during photosynthesis. Plants have evolved for hundreds of millions of years to harness the energy of the sun efficiently and effectively, something we humans have yet to perfect. What's really cool is that a byproduct of this reaction is oxygen, the air we need to breathe.
So that was botanist Barbara Ambrose of the New York Botanical Garden. What a perfect botanical response, right? The sun does all kinds of things for plants on Earth, right? It's that critical source of energy. It provides energy to everything. It's that beginning of the food chain, right? So what happens if we ask a photographer?
I know that our sun is a totally average yellow star, so let's concentrate on what is special. Of the countless stars in the sky, the sun is the only one I will ever see up close and personal. As I take pictures of its earthward face, I ponder the magic of my ordinariness, how I get to swim in lakes with liquid water, how our moon and sun are balanced at just the right distance so each appears the same size in our sky. And when they line up just right, they give us the solar eclipse and a fleeting glimpse of the outer atmosphere of our neighborhood star. In its brilliance, the sun defies more than a momentary glimpse. But today, with safe solar filters available to the amateur astronomer on a budget, I can photograph and share the workings of the distant universe from my own backyard. How cool is that?
Totally cool. But you see how the responses are very different depending on who you're asking. And so what we want everybody out there to do is share with us what the sun is or what the sun does to you. And we want to make it clear that, you know, here we've been asking a bunch of scientists, the Energy Secretary, astronomers. This is for everybody. We want you to You can tell us about how it's melting your popsicle. You can tell us about evaporation. You can show us how the sun affects your life.
Right. What does it do to your cat's behavior? My cat behaves very specifically in the context of the sun. I bet you might have some ideas about that.
Oh, you're giving out a cat suggestion.
I know, it's a terrible thing to do. Well,
no, let's see how many. And how do they respond? How do they send their stuff in to you?
That's a great question. So we've set up a hashtag, Explain the Sun. Use this hashtag when you make your Instagram photos of your awesome explanatory posters. Use this hashtag when you tweet your short videos of your sun explaining how the sun creates an eclipse. Mm-hmm. Do all of that. We also have a website, sciencefriday.com/scienceclub, where you can find more examples of ways that you can share things, where you can see more examples of scientist responses, and where you can find more information about this and previous science clubs.
Now, you have a special treat for people, right? If they want to participate, Ariel?
I do. So, a very generous donation from Rainbow Symphony. We have a special tool for viewing the sun. Now, usually when you look at the sun, it's actually really bad. Do not look at the sun. It is unsafe. It will harm your eyes. However, with special solar filters, like in these eclipse glasses, you can actually look at the sun and see it for the magnificent sphere in the sky that it is. If you go to our website, sciencefriday.com/scienceclub, we will give a select number of the first people to sign up free eclipse glasses so that you can go home and actually view the eclipse or the sun itself.
When the supply runs out, like they say, when the supply runs out, we run out of.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So they look something like those weird movie 3D glasses, right?
They're super geeky. When you look up at the sky with them, everyone will know that you're endeavoring in a scientific enterprise. Mm-hmm.
But if you put them on just in your house or something, you will not see anything. So you really got to wait till you're outside to try them out, because otherwise you'll just end up walking into walls.
Mm-hmm. So how long does this project last? What are we looking for?
We've got a whole month. So we're going to meet back here in early June and kind of talk about the explanations we've got, share some highlights. Throughout the month, we're going to have, you'll be able to listen to a bunch of really cool sun science. You'll be able to go onto our website and find a weekly sun activity from the Lawrence Hall of Science. We've also got some great, as we mentioned before, some great responses already from different types of scientists and individuals. So, you know, check back in with us through the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. And you can create whatever you like, right? You can respond anyway. You can make a video, you can sing, you can make an audio, you can make a project, you can...
I'm hoping we get at least one interpretive dance, a sculpture, a poster. The other thing that would be particularly cool would be, a play. Let's endeavor to make explanations what they should be, right? We want them to cite evidence, have reliable sources.
This isn't a contest, is it? We're not going to give prize to the best of anything.
No, definitely. There's no right answer. There's no prizes. We're going to show some of the things that people send us on our website at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub. We're going to talk about some of the really cool ones on the air back here in a month. There's no winner. Although, if there were a winner, we'd like to give a special honorable mention to the band They Might Be Giants.
The sun is a mass of incandescent gas, a gigantic nuclear furnace, where hydrogen is built into helium at a temperature of millions of degrees. Yo-ho, it's hot. The sun is not a place where we could live. But here on Earth, there'd be no life without the light it gives.
So they're pretty well known for that song. It's actually a cover of an older science song. But when the band was re-recording it a couple years ago for a new album of other science songs, Here Comes Science, they learned that those lyrics that they were singing were actually scientifically out of date. And so they actually had to write a new song. And if you go to our website, sciencefriday.com, you can hear more of that story and hear them performing the new version of the song in the Science Friday studios just a couple years ago.
Yeah, I remember that. They were great. That was a great, great story that they would take time out and fix it. Well, we're very excited about this. I'm going to go out and see what I can think about a way of dealing with the sun. You know, I used to love looking at solar eclipses through a box. You know, you put a pinhole camera in a box.
Right on. Absolutely.
Over your shoulder and then a little dark in the box there.
So we have a modified version of that experiment on our site. We will in a couple of weeks with binoculars, where you can use them to project the image of the sun onto a piece of paper and look for sunspots.
And so it's good for a month. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com/scienceclub.
You got it. Tweet with the hashtag Explain the Sun.
And we got all kinds of educational material for people
Tons.
There too, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ariel. Thank you, Charles.
Thanks a lot.
Ariel Zitch, Charles Berquist, our project directors on this one, the Science Club episode. Ah, yes, the Bee Gees. Takes me back to the 70s, my whole disco era when John Travolta and Donna Summers were dance hall legends. Well, now there is a new name to add to that pantheon, Tenodes Alles, known as the disco clam, Tenodes Alles. Researchers think these mollusks need their flashy attitudes for staying alive, literally. Here to talk about the disco clam in our newest video in the Macroscope series, our website video producer, Luke Graskiner. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira.
Hey there. So tell us about this disco clam.
Sure. Okay. So imagine just an ordinary white clam, a simple white clam. Now imagine as it slowly opens its shell, these long red shag carpet tentacles come out, about 2 inches long each. And there's this fleshy, pinkish, reddish kind of mass on the inside with filters. And then at the edges of the mouth of the clam, there's these thin neon flashes that strobe like electric. And it's really, really like you can see them from far away. They're just strobing. It's kind of like a little discotheque inside of a clamshell. It's really cool. Now, that's how it looks, but this is how it feels. Here's a preview of the video featuring the researcher, Lindsay Doherty.
Red frills and a flashy display make for a one-of-a-kind aquatic oddity.
I study disco clams. That's their colloquial name. Some people also call them electric scallops or electric clams. They get their names because they flash. They have about 40 eyes. They like to live inside crevices or holes inside the reef.
Wow, I can't wait to see this video.
They're really cool. They're absolutely amazing little creatures.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Luke Raskin, our video producer, about the disco clam. And you really have recreated the 70s moon there.
Yes, our producer, Christian Baker, he put on his disco funk voice specifically for this project. As you noticed, you heard, they have 40 eyes. Now, when I heard that, I was like, what? What would a clam need eyes for?
Yeah.
So these are tiny little photoreceptors. They have a lens, and they're in between the tentacles. And what they do is they sense it when something's looming over them so that the clam can shut. But in the case of the disco clam, it makes you wonder, why would you have this strobing? You know, can the eyes see this strobing? Turns out they probably can't. The eyes aren't actually able to see the strobing. So what do you need this kind of strobing for? What is this strobing in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
That's what the researcher, Lindsay Doherty at UC Berkeley, wants to find out, or has already started to find out. So if you look very closely at the microscopic structure of these little flashes, they're not actually bioluminescent. What you're looking at is kind of like a reflective tissue filled with silica nanospheres. So it's not like a glow stick. It doesn't emanate its own light. It just reflects the light that hits it. And in fact, these are so tightly packed and perfectly optimized to reflect the light at underneath the water, which is very different from the light above the water. So she's discovered this, and then she's wondering, why? Why would a clam have these flashy lips? And she's done a couple of tests. So what she's done is she's put the clam in a tank with a female clam, a male clam and a female clam. And they saw, is there more flashing? There would be more flashing if they're trying to attract a mate. Nope, no more flashing than normal. So, but they put a predator inside the tank, and all of a sudden the flashing increases. Or you loom over the clam, and all of a sudden that strobing increases. Oh, so maybe the strobing's sending a message. Well, it turns out that the disco clam is also toxic. It's got sulfur in its tentacles and in its lips.
So if you take a bite, if you're a predator and you take a bite, you're going away unhappy.
Yes, and in fact, there's one of its predators is the infamous mantis shrimp. Remember the mantis shrimp?
Oh, yeah. I actually had an aquarium once where I had a couple in there, and you could hear them. they smacking against stuff, right?
Yes, they have these little claws that can hit faster than they just punch, and they create cavitations, and they can crack open a shell. And this really brilliantly beautiful mantis shrimp can see all sorts of colors, and they can see that strobing. And there's this great video where you see this mantis shrimp coming up to a disco clam, and normally this would be, you know, game over. The mantis shrimp's going to win. But in this case, the mantis shrimp comes right up to the disco clam and all of a sudden just gets stunned. It doesn't know how to react to it. And it turns out it's absorbed some of this toxic sulfurous ooze that's come out of the disco clam. So, you know, the disco clam, it strobes, sends the message, and it puts its money where its mouth is.
Well, disco clam, I want to be a disco clam. On our website at sciencefriday.com.
Yes, it's called Flash of the Disco Clam.
Flash of the Disco Clam. And I guess there's really no follow-up. What do you do after a disco clam?
Well, they still want to find out all sorts of different things. How does the actual silica nanospheres get inside of those lips of the clam? How do they get in there? They think it could be from plankton called diatoms, but they're not exactly sure. They need to do more testing, of course.
What was it like filming the disco clam?
Well, our producer Christian Baker said it was really fun. They put these little injectors next to the disco clam, and they kind of spray plankton on them, and then you see them kind of come out like this this creature out of a sci-fi film. It's really, really cool.
All right. As I said, you can see the disco clam and all its a red shag glory up on our website. And if you like it and you want to see more fun videos, just click the subscribe button. Yeah, subscribe right beneath the video, and you'll get all our videos weekly. Luke, thank you.
Thank you.
Take time to be with us. Charles Berquist is our director, our senior producer, Christopher Taliata, Alexa Lim, our associate producer, SciArts producer, Annie Minoff. Luke Roskett is our video producer, our production assistant, Becky Fogel, Rich Kim, our technical director, Sarah Fishman, our engineer, at the controls here in the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. And what's got science, prize, beer, and me? It's our first ever Science Friday Trivia Night. Yes, coming at the Bell House in Brooklyn next Wednesday, May 13th. You can get your tickets at sciencefriday.com/trivia. Get them before they run out. That's next Wednesday, May 13th in Brooklyn at the Bell House, sciencefriday.com/trivia. Get your tickets now. Have a happy VE Day. I'm Ira Flato in New York.